Thank you, Mr. Williams. Had an interesting sermonette in Hickory this morning. It was a parable. It was a parable of the first shall be last and the last shall be first. I know when we think of parables, we often think, well, all the parables in the Bible are found in the New Testament and the Gospels primarily, of course. We often think of the parables of Jesus in the New Testament Gospel accounts. But I'm going to go someplace different with you today. I'm going to go to the Old Testament to look at a parable. I happened to find this parable. I was just looking for, well, what shall I talk about in the sermon? I was looking through Psalms, and then I got back into the Chronicles and found my way back into Judges and looked at the heading on one of the pages of Judges, and it said, the parable of the trees. And I said, what's that? I don't remember. So I thought, I'll take a little closer look at the parable of the trees. Well, we're going to take a look at it together today. This parable and the story surrounding it, I believe, provide a valuable lesson for us today. Many of us are familiar with the story of Gideon in Judges. When we think of Judges, we think of Samson, Delilah, and you know, maybe some of the other more famous judges. Gideon, of course, comes to mind. We remember that Gideon was going to go fight the Midianites, and he's got this big army, and God says, that's too many. And he says, well, those who are afraid, they're afraid to die, send them home. We don't want brave soldiers. Well, 10,000, well, that's still too many. So you know the story. He ends up with 300, the ones who lapped the water, putting their hands to their mouth. But perhaps we are not quite as familiar with the story that follows. The story of Gideon's son named Abimelech. Judges chapter 8. Let's begin by seeing what happens immediately after Gideon's successful battle. I will be reading mostly from the Living Bible today. I will also add a lot of paraphrase to try to get this story clear in our minds. Sometimes when we read this story from the King James Version, even the New King James, you look at it and say, what? What did that say? So hopefully I'll try to bring the story alive a little bit as we take a look at this story of Abimelech, Judges 8, chapter 20, or verse 22. Now the men of Israel said to Gideon, you be our king. See, he had saved them from the Midianites, so they want to bestow an honor on him. You be our king. You and your sons and all your descendants shall be our rulers, for you have saved us from Midian. And Gideon replies, I will not be your king, nor shall my son. The Lord is your king. Now, that's quite a response. That's very important for us to notice here. It's an attitude of humility on Gideon's part, because we think, well, what normally or naturally would Gideon have said? Well, apparently God has chosen me. I mean, after all, he did give me this miraculous victory over the Midianites. I mean, how else could that happen, you know, unless God's clearly working with me? And if you really want me, okay, sure, I'll be your king. Yeah, go ahead, crown me with many crowns, right? He did not give in to that temptation. Instead, he corrected them. He said, I don't even want my son to be king. You should know that only God is your king. And so a tremendous example for us of faith in God's promises, that he was going to be there, that he would be their king. And it teaches us a lesson in humility and loyalty to God. So sometimes we could stop there. We'll say, well, that's a good lesson to learn. But I think what goes on to happen here in Gideon's life, he's not done. He does something else that appears to be an unexpected event. He makes an unexpected request. Goes on to say, in verse 24, however, I have one request. Now, what would that be? Well, give me all your earrings collected from your fallen foes. For the troops of Midian, being Ishmaelites, they all wore gold earrings. Well, sure we will. Gladly, the people replied. And so they spread out a sheet for everyone to throw in the gold earrings that he'd gathered. Their value was estimated at $25,000. I suspect, you know, maybe that's even more today. Not including crescents and pendants or the royal clothing of the kings or the chains that had been put around the camels' necks. You ever think of golden chains that are put around camels' necks? Well, apparently Imagine what that might be worth, at least today. Well, so now what does Gideon do with them? He makes an ephod. You remember what an ephod is? Like a breastplate? Remember the high priest had the ephod that had those jewels in it, you know? And so it's like a breastplate made from gold, and he places it in Ophrah, Gideon's hometown. So we can look at this and say, well, that's interesting, but I think we need to ask, why? Why is this here? Why is this recorded for us? Why is it important? Well, in context, the people have attempted to glorify and exalt Gideon because, after all, he's delivered them from their hated enemy, the Midianites. Gideon has refused to become their king, but instead it seems like he's recalling something from their history. And he's trying to get the people to listen, to understand something about their history and what lesson they should have learned from history. So Gideon says, I want an ephod made. Perhaps it's referring to an incident that's recorded for us in Exodus 32. If you turn back to there, keep your place in Judges because we will come right back. But Exodus 32, remember this story. Moses had been gone for quite a while, and the people begin to say, he's gone. Verse 1, when Moses didn't come back down the mountain right away, the people went to Aaron. Look, they said, make us a god to lead us. You know, another god. For this fellow Moses, who brought us here out of Egypt, well, he's disappeared. He's gone. Something must have happened to him. Well, Aaron says, okay, give me your gold earrings. And so they all did. Everyone, men and women, boys and girls. So Aaron melted the gold, and then he molded it and fashioned it into the form of, not an ephod, but the calf. Remember the calf? And the people then begin to cry out to this calf, oh, Israel, this is the God that brought you up out of Egypt. Really? How could they do that? But anyway, is there some connection? The story seems to have a familiar overtone to it. Maybe Gideon's thinking about this. Is he trying to get the people to think about that they're asking for something physical to worship as an alternative to establishing him as their king? Now, apparently, Gideon knew the people were quite inclined to idols, to idolatry, despite what they had seen and experienced. So perhaps he thinks, well, it might be a good idea to use the ephod. At least they won't be bowing down and trying to worship me. They want to establish me as their king. I don't want that, but well, maybe it'll be okay if we have this ephod. Well, it doesn't work out so well. Verse 28, we're in Judges 8. All Israel soon, didn't take them long, soon began worshiping the ephod. And so it became an evil deed that Gideon and his family did. All Israel begins worshiping a golden stone. And we wonder, how's that possible? How can people be so gullible, if you will? When we look back at this story now, we say, that is absolutely crazy. I mean, these are intelligent people. They'd witnessed the power of God, and now they're falling once again into idol worship. They're going to bow down and worship this ephod thing. It's as crazy as worshiping this golden calf. Oh, this is what brought us up out of Egypt. Well, they knew where the gold had come from. It doesn't make any sense. Why is that recorded for us? And what can we learn from this? Well, just think. We know the power of the true God, don't we? We know of God. We have been witness to his miracles in our lives. But do we sometimes turn our attention away from God towards something physical that we might worship? Turn to idolatry, putting something relatively worthless, even though it might have been worth $25,000, compared to God, it was worthless. How much of a mistake was that for Gideon? Was God indeed pleased with his behavior, or was there something, a price to be paid? For now, nothing happens. He makes the ephod, people go about their business, time passes, nothing happens. Verse 28, this is the true account of how Midian was subdued by Israel. And Midian never recovered. The land was at peace for the next 40 years. All during Gideon's lifetime. He returns home. Gideon eventually has 70 sons because he married many wives. He also had a concubine in Shechem who presented him with a son named Abimelech. Now, often we'll just stop here. Okay, that's nice. But let's stop here and note why that son, of all sons, this son is particularly noted and named. Abimelech is actually a symbolic name. You'll see reference to the name Abimelech in other places. It's a royal title that means, "My father is king." My father is king. Now, Gideon naming his son, "My father is king," what had they tried to get him to do, right? Maybe a little slight there, a little recognition of what Gideon effectively was and maybe what he wanted to be, but he knew, no, I can't do that. God is the king, not me. But yet, I really am important after all, aren't I? Perhaps he was hopeful of being blessed with some kind of royal succession, that maybe God would in fact make Abimelech the king, as presumptuous as that might seem to be. Whatever the case, as we will see, maybe Gideon didn't have that in mind, but I'll tell you what, the kid named "My father is king," he had that in mind. Abimelech wanted to be acknowledged as the king. Verse 32, Gideon now dies, an old, old man, it says, and he was buried in the sepulcher of his father Joash in Ophrah. So Gideon lives out a long and happy life. Things seem to have worked out well for him. God blesses him with a long life. 70 sons? Perhaps, we don't even know how many daughters, maybe 70 daughters, we don't know. But he lives a long time in peace. And he just died. And we think, end of story. It's not. Had Gideon really pleased God? You see, I think it's important for us to see the rest of the story. God works with the big picture. God works at things from the, you know, the 10,000 mile level, you know, if you will, and we're down here. He's looking at the big picture. And he's also not limited by time, even though time has passed. Verse 33. But as soon as Gideon was dead, the Israelites began to worship the idols, Baal and Baal-berith. And so they no longer considered the Lord as their God, although he had rescued them from all their enemies on every side. They did not show any kindness to the family of Gideon, despite everything he had done for them. Some respect for Gideon now. He's dead. A clear insult to Gideon. Doesn't matter. He's dead. So it appears perhaps this ephod incident that Gideon made was simply for them a means to an end. We're going to institute idolatry after all. We don't want anything to do with God. Israel clearly had a desire to forsake God and to turn completely to idolatry. And they had apparently only been holding back out of fear of what Gideon might do when he was alive, or out of some partial respect for Gideon while he was living. Perhaps it's no wonder God says it was an evil deed that Gideon had done in setting up the ephod, as if it gave Israel an excuse to engage in just a little sin. It doesn't matter. No one's really paying attention to this golden ephod. It's not so bad. God doesn't really care what we're doing here anyway, does he? Besides, all these years, everything's been fine. 40 years have passed, and we've been living in peace, and everything's fine. The Midianites haven't bothered us. Hey, you know what? Maybe it's because of the ephod that we've been in peace. That's it. Judges 9. Pick up the story here of Gideon's son Abimelech. It goes on. One day, Gideon's son Abimelech visited his uncles, his brothers, his mother's brothers in Shechem. Well, we need to get a little history lesson. We're trying to establish a backstory before we get into the parable and our lesson for the sermon. So they're at Shechem. What is Shechem? Go back to Genesis 34. Again, holding your place. In Genesis 34, we have the story of, we'll call him Prince Shechem. He's the son of King Hamor of the Hivites. Shechem is the one who had a look at Miss Dinah, who was the daughter of Israel by Leah. Well, Shechem thought she was pretty fine. He lusted after her. He raped her. To seek revenge, the brothers convince King or Prince Shechem and King Hamor and all the other men of the city, well, okay, I'll tell you what you do. If you all agree to be like us, if you all agree to be circumcised in the flesh, then yes, we'll allow this marriage to take place, all is forgiven, and we'll become allies. Well, that sounded pretty good. You know, I don't really want to go through this, but considering the alternative, well, we know it was a trick, just so that they could weaken them. And for grown men to go through that procedure, that would weaken them. And then, of course, they slaughtered them in avenging the rape of their sister Dinah. But Shechem, this is the beginning of Shechem being associated with lust, greed, taking, idolatry, has to do with Shechem, chapter 35 in Genesis. Move on to Bethel now and settle there, God says to Jacob, and build an altar to worship me, the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. And so Jacob instructed all those in his household to destroy the idols that they had brought with them, and to wash themselves, and to put on fresh clothing, because we are going to Bethel, he told them, and there I will build an altar to the God who answers prayers, the God who answered my prayer in the day of my distress, and who was with me on my journey. And so they gave Jacob all of their idols, all their golden earrings, and he buried them. Where did he bury them? He buried them beneath the oak tree, sometimes it will say the terebinth tree, near Shechem. So apparently a city has been established in remembrance of Prince Shechem. This now becomes the location of the symbolic burial of idolatry. Idolatry is put away and buried at Shechem under the oak tree. The next place we're going to see reference to Shechem is with Joshua, at a very famous event recorded for us in Joshua 24, verse 1. Joshua 24, verse 1. Joshua summoned all the people of Israel to him. Where did they assemble? At Shechem. With all of their leaders, the elders, the officers, and all the judges. And so they all came, and they presented themselves before God. So now Joshua gives a speech. Joshua reviews the history with his people, and he reminds them of all that God has done for them since the time they left Egypt. He's doing that for a reason. Verse 14. So revere the Eternal and serve Him in sincerity and truth, he says. Put away forever the idols that your ancestors worshipped when they lived beyond the Euphrates and in Egypt. You need to worship the Lord alone. But, he says, if you are unwilling to obey the Lord, then decide today, who will you obey? Will it be the gods of your ancestors beyond the Euphrates River, or will it be the gods of the Amorites who live here in this land? But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. We sing the song, right? This is the context this is set in. And the people replied, we'll never forsake the Lord. We'll never worship other gods. Yes, verse 18, yes, we choose the Lord, for He alone is our God. And Joshua says to the people, I don't think you can do it. You can't worship the God, the Lord your God. He is holy. He is jealous. He won't forgive your rebellion and your sins. I know you people. I know what you're inclined to do. I'm not sure you can do this. If you forsake Him, and if you worship other gods, He will turn upon you. He will destroy you, even though He's taken such care of you for such a long time. Did you hear those words? He will turn on you and destroy you, though He has taken care of you for such a long time. But the people answer, we choose the Lord. And Joshua said, you have heard it yourselves. You've heard yourself say it. You have chosen to obey the Lord. Yes, they replied, we are our witnesses. All right, he said, then you now must destroy all the idols that you own. You must obey the Lord God of Israel. And the people replied to Joshua, yes, yes, we will worship and obey the Lord alone. And so Joshua there made a covenant with them that very day at Shechem. At Shechem, committing them to a permanent and binding contract a permanent and binding contract between themselves and God. So the people of Israel are once again on record of making a contract with God. They promise, we will only worship the true God. We will forsake idolatry. And they agreed that they know God will punish us. God can destroy us if we turn back to idolatry. We acknowledge that. We say that. We are witnesses to that. And this was done at Shechem, the same place where Jacob had their forefathers bury the idols and where they pledged loyalty to God. Judges 9. So we already know from Judges 8 that the people had returned to idolatry after the death of Gideon. Now Abimelech is on the scene, and he, remember his attitude? My father is king, I want to be the king. So Abimelech has this evil scheme that he's plotting for power. Verse 2. He says, go and talk to the leaders who are at Shechem. Of all places, in all of Israel, this is happening at Shechem. And ask them whether or not, do you want to be ruled by these 70 kings at, you know, the time of Judges? And what confusion can that be? We have a hard time getting along with one. You know, 70 people want to be your judge now? Or do you want to be led just by one strong leader like me? I mean, look how powerful and strong and obviously blessed by God that I am. Your own flesh and blood. I'm from here. My mom's from here. You all know that. So his uncles went to the leaders of the city and proposed Abimelech's scheme. And they decided that, yes, since his mother was, in fact, a native of their town, Shechem, that they're going to go along with it. And so they gave him money from the temple offerings. They gave him money from the temple offerings of the idol Baal-berith, which Abimelech used to hire some worthless loafers who agreed to do whatever he wanted them to do. Mercenaries, you might say. But let's notice that the people, where are they and what are they doing? They have returned to idolatry. Now, why in the world would the leaders of the city go along with Abimelech's plan? It doesn't tell us much. It only tells us it was because his mother, Gideon's unnamed concubine, remember, was from Shechem. But consider that Israel was, in fact, looking at all the other nations around them who all had one powerful king. And Abimelech is making a case. He's asking them, do you want 70 kings ruling over them? Or don't you all just want to be like everybody else around you? Why would you want to stand out as different? You know, it makes much more sense to just have one strong king like me. Well, they must have literally idolized Abimelech, their hometown hero, who apparently, oh well, go ahead with your idol worship. It's okay. Nobody really cares. You go ahead with that. You have your fun. Do your thing. And things are about to turn tragic. Verse 5. Abimelech took them, these worthless loafers, if you will, or mercenaries. He took them to his father Gideon's home at Ophrah. Remember, that's where Gideon had set up the golden ephod at Ophrah, and where he had built an altar. So there, upon one stone, Abimelech and his men slaughtered all 70 of his half-brothers, except for the youngest, Jotham, who escaped and hid. A stone. Perhaps this was a stone from the altar that Gideon had built after his encounter with the angel of the Lord that we can read about back in Judges chapter 6, when the angel of the Lord appears to him and tells him about he's going to overthrow the Midianites. And they have the wool fleece that has dew on it, and then it doesn't, and so on. Now, how this was able to be pulled off, it's not revealed, but apparently all of these 69 brothers were completely taken by surprise. They had no idea what was about to happen, and they were utterly defenseless. Abimelech perpetrates an act of total savagery and cruelty upon his brothers. And so we ask why. God was there. He was on the scene. He knew what was happening. Why did God allow that to happen to all of Gideon's sons? Gideon, the good guy. His sons are all destroyed. Does it go back to the ephod that Gideon set up for his people? It was a horrible slaughter of all these brothers. You can see history repeating itself if you want to make a note, 2 Kings 10, we have the murder of the 70 sons of King Ahab. What connection might there be? But incredibly, young Jotham escapes with his life and goes into hiding. Evidently, God is sparing his life. We'll see why momentarily. Verse 6, then the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo called a meeting under the oak tree beside the garrison at Shechem. And Abimelech is acclaimed king of Israel. Did you notice where that was? Under the oak tree at Shechem. Abimelech is acclaimed the king. This is the same oak tree where we read earlier in Genesis 34, where Jacob had buried the objects of idol worship. The gold and the earrings of the people of Shechem had been buried years earlier. The people had promised to put away foreign gods and serve the only true God of Israel. They had promised again at the time of Joshua, apparently at this very same place. It's becoming quite significant in our story. So did these people understand what Abimelech had done? Apparently the answer to that is yes, they did. Was it possible that the people were just too afraid of him? I'm not going to oppose him. You go. I'm not going to do it. I'm too afraid. Now we're going to find out a little bit more about Jotham as he is going to now introduce us at this time in the story. He's going to introduce us to the parable of the trees. Verse 7. When Jotham heard this, so they proclaimed him king now, right? When Jotham heard this, he stood at the top of Mount Gerizim. Now, Mount Gerizim is located just adjacent to Shechem. It's up on this mountain, and he can look over from the mountain and see all of the city below him. And apparently, you can hear from up there. So he shouts across to the men of Shechem, and he says, if you want God's blessings, then listen to me. Once upon a time, the trees decided to elect a king. So first they asked the olive tree, but it refused. The olive tree said, should I quit producing the olive oil that blesses God and man just to wave to and fro over the other trees? And so then they said to the fig tree, well, then you be our king. And the fig tree refused. Should I quit producing sweetness and fruit just to lift my head above all the other trees, it asked? So then they said to the grapevine, you reign over us. And the grapevine replies, well, should I quit producing the wine that cheers both God and man just to be mightier than all the other trees? So then all the trees finally turned to the bramble or the thorn bush. You be our king, they exclaimed. And the thorn bush replies, if you really, really want me, then come and humble yourselves beneath my shade. But if you refuse, let fire flame forth from me and burn down even the great cedars of Lebanon. And so that's the parable. Obviously, it's relating to what has been happening in Israel and Shechem and with Abimelech. Verse 16, let's continue the story as we see what Jotham is going to now say to the people after he's given them this parable. It says, now make sure, people, that you have done the right thing in making Abimelech your king, and that you have done right by Gideon and all of his descendants. Where were his descendants? For my father fought for you. He risked his life for you, and he delivered you from the Midianites. And yet you revolted against him, and you killed his 70 sons upon one stone. And now you've chosen his slave girl's son, Abimelech, to be your king, just because he's your relative. So if you're sure that you have done the right thing by Gideon and his descendants, then may you and Abimelech have a long and happy life together. He knew what was really going on. He knew that isn't what happened. Verse 20, but if you have not been fair to Gideon, then may Abimelech destroy all the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo, and may they destroy Abimelech. What's happening here is Jotham is explaining the parable to them. You see, all the mighty trees rejected the offer to be king because they perceived God would be displeased because God is the king of the forest, if you will. But the thorn bush accepts, but with conditions. Yeah, I'll be your king, but you humble yourselves under me, a lowly thorn bush. You even are under me. Abimelech, of course, is the thorn bush. So let's see what happens then after the people choose Abimelech as the thorn bush ruler. Notice there has been a warning to the people that if they refuse to honor the way of Gideon, their father, if they refuse to worship God, then he said, then may Abimelech destroy you and be destroyed himself. That's what Jotham said will happen. Verse 21, Jotham's afraid, but Jotham escapes. And he lives in Beer, B-E-E-R. I wouldn't want to say he lives in Beer. It's probably pronounced Beer. I'll have to ask. I have to ask him how you pronounce that, Mr. Murphy. 3 years later, 3 years pass. God stirred up trouble between King Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem, and they revolted. So being ruled by evil King Abimelech wasn't so great after all? What kind of trouble was going on? It must have been a difficult 3 years for the people. What we're seeing happening is this thornbush ruler, Abimelech, talked about flames. He's about to get burned by his own flames. Verse 24. In the events that followed, both Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem, who aided him in killing Gideon's 70 sons, they were all given their just punishment for these murders. For the men of Shechem had set up an ambush for Abimelech along the trail at the top of the mountain. And notice this inset. While they were waiting for him to come along, they robbed everyone else who passed that way. Men of great upstanding character, right? But someone warned Abimelech about their plot. Always someone with a big mouth, right? You've got spies in the ranks. So Abimelech is going to get away with it after all. Well, all the mercenaries who actually did the murdering of Gideon's sons, they're all killed. Again, some begin to conclude, where's God? Where's his fairness? God's not fair. Well, now we're introduced to a new character who has no loyalty to Abimelech, but he does apparently have quite strong ambitions of his own. And his name is Gaal. Verse 26, at that time, Gaal, the son of Ebed, moved to Shechem with his brothers, and he's influential. He becomes, very soon, one of the leading citizens. During the harvest feast at Shechem that year, which was being held in the temple of the local god, harvest feast that year? Sounds like a counterfeit Feast of Tabernacles, doesn't it? Well, anyway, the wine is flowing freely, and everyone, strangely enough, everyone begins cursing Abimelech. Who is Abimelech? They said. Gaal shouts, who's Abimelech? Why should Abimelech be our king? Why should we be his servants? That Abimelech and his friend Zebal, they should be our servants. So I say, down with Abimelech. Make me your king. And you'll see what happens to this Abimelech. I won't even call him king. And I'm going to tell Abimelech that you go get an army. You come on out and you fight me and let's see who wins. Clearly, Gaal is very ambitious. Gaal wants to, be the king. I'll be the tallest tree in the forest. Gaal is forgetting about something. He should have read a little bit of history. I think he knew some. He should have known about the God of Israel and the God of Israel's great power. It hadn't been all that long since the incredible, miraculous defeat of the Midianites some 45 or 50 years earlier. He probably knew about it. But, that was so long ago. So I wonder if sometimes things that happened so long ago, 45 or 50 years ago, for those of us who are over 60, that doesn't seem so long ago. I wonder if we've forgotten about how God so miraculously has intervened and intervened in his church. some 40 or 50 years ago. Again, I refer you to the autobiography of Mr. Armstrong. Absolutely miraculous things were taking place in the church at that time. So where is God, Gaul asked? Has he forgotten us? Has he forgotten you people? You claim to be his people. I don't see him. An Israelite trying to serve God at this time might certainly be wondering that too. Well, God seems to have disappeared. God maybe has forsaken us. Maybe we should humble ourselves under Gaul, because after all, he seems so sincere. He just wants to help us. Again, sometimes I'm afraid that's what people do in the midst of tragedy. They turn, instead of to God, they turn to a false hope with false promises of deliverance. Because God's not around. What's happened to his promised intervention? I've heard all these promises that God's going to intervene and help us and solve our problems and give us great blessings, but I'm still struggling with my problems. I don't seem to see where God is now. Maybe I'll try something else. That's why we had a sermon recently about perspective. While we might not see it, and often we just don't, God is involved. God is directing things according to his plan and his purpose for each one of us. So let's see how this plays out for Gaul. Verse 30. When Zebal, now he's the leading guy. Let's call him the mayor of the city. When Zebal, the mayor, heard what Gaul was saying, well, he was furious. So he sent messengers to Abimelech telling him, Gaul, son of Ebed, and his relatives have come here to live in Shechem. And now they're arousing the entire city in rebellion against you. So come by night with an army and hide out in the fields. And in the morning, as soon as it's daylight, we'll storm the city. And when he and those who are with him come out against you, well, then you can do with them as you wish. So Abimelech and his men marched through the night, and they split off into four groups, stationing themselves around the city. So all points around the city, there's Abimelech's men. Well, the next morning starts out, it's just a normal day. Gaul and the other leaders, they sit at the city gate, as was the custom to do. They're discussing various issues with the local leaders, certainly including Mayor Zebal. Abimelech and his men start the march toward the city. Gaul's, you know, sitting there having his discussion, his morning coffee. He looks up and he says, what's that? I see something. And so he exclaims to Mayor Zebal, look over that mountain. Doesn't it look like people coming down? No, Zebal said, you're just imagining things. You're seeing shadows that just look like men. No, look over there, Gaul said. I'm sure I see people coming towards us. And look, there are even others coming along the road past the oak tree. You know, the oak of Me'anannim. What does that word mean? Sometimes we'll just pass over something. The word Me'anannim means the tree of enchantment or the diviner's tree. I wonder what tree that is. Likely the very same tree we've already made reference to. Well, verse 38, Zebal turns on Gaul triumphantly. Now, where's that big mouth of yours, he demands. And who was it that was saying, who's Abimelech and why should he be our king? And the men you taunted and cursed, they're right outside the city. So you go on. You go out there. You go fight them. This is a big oops moment for Gaul. I couldn't imagine that happening. He thought the people would forget about Abimelech. Of course they'll follow him, because nobody likes Abimelech after all. But Gaul's caught up in his lust for power that he couldn't see that there'd been a trap set for him. Despite the evil of Abimelech, instead, family loyalties were running deep. No outsider, this interloper, this Gaul, of all the gall, right? No one was going to come in like him and rule over us. But now, Gaul has no choice. He has to fight with what few men of Shechem who remain loyal to him, and there were a few. He was backed into a corner. I wonder if we ever feel backed into a corner and feel, I have no way out of this predicament that I've got myself into. If I do what I think I have to do, then I'm fighting against God's will. But there doesn't seem to be any other choice, so, oh well, I guess I got to do it. Our human reasoning would lead us to believe that God, no way possible he could intervene and help us in the circumstances that I find myself in now, because it's impossible. Forgetting that God is the God of the impossible. You see, that attitude would be wrong. We can always turn to God for help. Gaal wasn't going to do that. He's got to fight. Verse 39. So Gaal led the men of Shechem into the battle, and he fought with Abimelech. But he was defeated. And many of the men of Shechem were left wounded all the ways to the city gate. So not a good outcome for Gaal. He had been so arrogant, so prideful, thinking that people, naturally, you're going to reject Abimelech, and of course you'll support me. I'm probably much better looking. We are reminded that pride goes before a fall. Verse 41. Abimelech was living at Aramah at this time, and Mer Zebal drove Gaal and his relatives out of Shechem and would not let them live there any longer. So the next day the men of Shechem went out to battle again. Why are they going out to battle again? Well, remember, many of the people of Shechem had revolted against Abimelech, now seen as the tyrant that he is. Well, Gaal's defeated. They're not done fighting. They still want to be freed from tyrant Abimelech. So they're going to go fight again. However, someone told Abimelech about their plans. Oh, there goes that spy network again. So Abimelech, he had divided his men into three groups hiding in the fields. And when the men of the city went out to attack, he and his men jumped up from their hiding places. It was an ambush. And began killing them. Abimelech stormed the city gate to keep the men of Shechem from getting back in, while his other two groups cut them off in the fields. It's a slaughter. The battle went on all day before Abimelech finally captured the city of Shechem, killed its people, and levels it to the ground. This is the evil of Abimelech, the son of Gideon. He had wanted to rule over these people, but when he couldn't have his way, he destroys them and the city. So he wasn't going to listen to them. He wasn't going to try to resolve their issues. So the obvious answer is kill everyone. That's a loving leader, isn't it? Yeah. I really care about my people after you're dead. So Shechem, the city where Israel had twice earlier made a covenant with God that they would forsake idolatry, they'll serve only the true God, they have now received the penalty that Joshua told them would happen if they would do that. Remember what was said? He will turn upon you and destroy you, even though he has taken care of you for such a long time. And now these people, they're dead. Verse 46. The people at the nearby town of Migdal. Now, if you're following along in another version besides the Living Version, you're seeing probably here, instead of Migdal, you're seeing Tower of Shechem. Well, I wonder what that meant. And so let's use the town of Migdal, saw what was happening, took refuge in the fort next to the temple of Baal-berith. Well, the word Migdal, what does it mean? Tower. Tower of Shechem. I'm going to read this out of the New King James Version. When all the men of the Tower of Shechem, Migdal, had heard that, they now enter the stronghold of the temple of God? The temple of the god Berith. But it was told Abimelech that all the men of the Tower of Shechem had fled there and now were gathered in the tower. So apparently this fortress near Shechem, the people have fled to. It seems like their only hope. These people are afraid that Abimelech's coming after them. And indeed he is. But note where they take refuge, adjacent to a pagan temple, Baal-berith. Verse 47, when Abimelech learned of this, he led his forces to the mountain where he began chopping a bundle of firewood and placed it upon his shoulder. And he tells his men, do as I have done. So each of them quickly cut a bundle and carried it back to the town where, following Abimelech's example, the bundles were piled against the walls of the fortress and set on fire. And so all the people inside the tower, about 1,000 men and women, perished in the flames. Once again, absolute, merciless evil. Nobody escapes from Migdal, the Tower of Shechem. What motivates a man to do such evil? And why did God allow it? These were, as we could say, fine people, innocent people. Well, they were living in a land of idol worship. Many of them were serving Baal. But what's God teaching us today with that example? Is it just a story for us to read through and really not paying attention to? It has nothing to do with us living in the 21st century today. I think we're to learn that idolatry leads to death. We know God will resurrect all these people. They'll be asleep for just an instant. And they'll all, the people we've talked about today, will live again in the great white throne judgment. They will live happy, productive, abundant lives as they learn God's way of life. And they also prepare for immortality in the kingdom of God. Again, God always uses the big picture. He always sees things in a different way, a different perspective than we do. And he uses stories like this to teach us some valuable lessons. So Abimelech, we think this is the end. He's got nothing left. He's not done yet. Verse 50. Abimelech next attacks the nearby city of Thebes and captures it. However, there's a fort inside that city, perhaps a tower, likely a tower. And the entire population who is left fled into it, barricaded the gate, climbed to the top of the roof, and they're going to watch what's going on. But as Abimelech was also preparing to burn it down, a woman on the roof threw down a stone. It landed on Abimelech's head, crushing his skull. He's not dead. He groans to his youthful armor bearer, "Kill me. Kill me. Never let it be said that a woman killed Abimelech." And so the young man pierced him through with a sword, and Abimelech died. And when the men saw that he was dead, they disbanded and returned home. They had nothing left to do. Thus God punished both Abimelech and the men of Shechem for their sin of murdering Gideon's 70 sons. And so the curse of Jotham, Gideon's son, came true. You remember what the curse was in verse 20? If you have not been fair to Gideon, then may Abimelech destroy the citizens of Shechem, and may they destroy Abimelech. That has now happened. And so unexpectedly, the story ends in a way that we would have never imagined. How is it that woman found a stone? How is it she just happened to, the wind velocity is just enough, I throw it just enough force, really? Right on the spot of the top of Abimelech's head. I think verse 57 shows that God was directing this, because remember it says God punished. So again, why do we cover the story today? Just one of those interesting stories we don't really hear that much about. I know it was kind of a new story to me. Or does God have a valuable lesson that he wants us to learn from this? I don't often quote from Matthew Henry commentary, but I will today, because he had a very insightful comment about this. Quote, "Though wickedness may prosper for a while, it will not prosper always. The history of mankind, if truly told, would greatly resemble that of this chapter." In other words, the story of Abimelech. "The records of what are called splendid events present here to us such contests for power, such scenes, though praised of men, fully explain the Scriptures' doctrine of the deceitfulness and the desperate wickedness of the human heart, the force of men's lust, and the effect of Satan's influence. End of the quote. In this story, we have seen that even with the recent incredible miracles that was performed by God through Gideon, a man they revered, people still quickly gave in to the pulls of idolatry and greed. The human heart, human nature. They wanted to just simply be like everybody else. That's not so bad. I'm going to be like everyone else. They did not want God telling them what to do. They did not want God to be the supreme ruler. No God is going to rule over me. Despite what they had seen, they could not learn to trust God for guidance and for His protection. It should have been obvious. It was clearly there for them to see. We also have seen incredible miracles from God in our lives. We all can have a story that we could tell. And we know all the lessons of history recorded for us in the pages of the Bible. We know the power of God. We know that God has a great master plan. We go to the Holy Days every year and we reenact that master plan. We know that He's got a plan for all of mankind. People wonder why bad things happen to good people. You and I know the answer to that. We can explain it. We know God's plan. We know God is the essence of love, not just for us, but He loves all mankind. He wants all of mankind to be in His family. We have no excuses for doubting God. None. And yet, despite that, we resist. We resist against letting go, giving God full trust, full confidence, full obedience. Oh, I'm not sure God's that strong. And somehow we continue to think that our way is the best way. Instead of trusting God to work out things, not on our timeline, but His. So we think that we can safely, it's no problem, it's all right. We can put other things right now because I don't see any other option. So I can put other things first in my lives before God. I really won't suffer any consequences because God does love me. And we also forget that our adversary, Satan the devil, will be looking for that attitude in us. And he'll say, that's right. That's right. You go right ahead. It'll be okay. Just this once. Nobody knows. God understands. So easy for us to fall back into neglect. Shall we say laziness? Self-centeredness? And we know what that's like. We've all been through it. And we can all say together that God's mercy towards us is absolutely limitless. How many times do we go before God and say, thank you so much for the mercy you show me? The people of Shechem made some pretty bad mistakes. And they paid a dear price for it, didn't they? Most of them lost their lives in these battles. And when they wake up, they're going to be quick, very quick to acknowledge, oh, I made a mistake. And they're going to accept the ways of God. And they're going to learn, I should have trusted Him all along. And Gideon's going to say, yeah. And Moses is going to say, yeah. Joshua. They're going to be so thankful to learn about Jesus Christ and that He paid the penalty of sin for them. He would make eternal life possible for them. The Bible does tell us over and over again that we will reap what we sow and that our sins eventually will find us out. A lot of time passed for Gideon. People thought, we're home free, everything's fine. Even today, people make the decision to reject God's way of life. They've been exposed to it, they've seen it, they know it, but too hard. Sometimes this happens in late teenage years. The older teens say, I believe I'll find my own way. Nobody tells me what to do. And they reject the wise counsel of their parents and others. And you know what? Nothing happens. Life goes on. And they think, see, I didn't really have to submit to God. Nothing bad happened to me. In fact, I'm successful. But God's still there. They think He's not watching. They think He doesn't care. Like Abimelech. He was so arrogant. So indestructible, he thought. He thought the people adore me after all. that he was wrong, and God sent a rock to the top of his head. You numbskull. And he learned the meaning of that. And Abimelech's going to have a lot to learn when he wakes up. I suspect he's going to have a long talk with his father, Gideon. But we don't have to make those mistakes, do we, today? We just don't have to do that. There will, in fact, be consequences to pay for bad judgments. Sometimes we're pretty good at that. The decisions that we make, even if those consequences don't come quickly or don't come at all in this lifetime. We can learn from others about how important it is to always trust God, no matter the outward appearance, because it's a different perspective. God's always right. The people of Israel saw the miracles of God through Gideon. They knew their history. They knew about the Red Sea. They knew the plagues. They knew the firstborn. They knew all that. They knew God's power of deliverance. They knew all of that. These are people who did not have access to God's Holy Spirit. Even they should have been able to obviously see these larger-than-life miracles in their history. They should have known. But in the mob mentality of the moment, you know, people get stirred up. And people don't think logically sometimes. Why did they stop looking to God for protection, given what they knew to be true about God? Wow, how's that possible? And we could ask, well, okay, what's the mob mentality of today? Is it peer pressure? Peer pressure at school? I know what that's like. Is it negative influence from friends or family? What's pressuring us to choose the wrong path? What's pressuring us to even leave the church? Does God care? Yeah. Actually, God is watching us. He's very concerned. He loves us. We are His called out ones. We are His church. When we pray and we ask God for help from our trials and deliverance from our trials, and we don't see anything happen, He's there. He still really will act. He will answer our prayers, but in His will and in His way, with what's best for us, from a perspective that we cannot see, but He can. Those who follow Satan's way of pride and exalting the self will be brought down. And that brings us to the ultimate lesson of the parable of the trees. Recall the account of Lucifer in Isaiah 14 and verse 12. Again, we're familiar with this account. Lucifer rebelled, and so the lament, "How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground?" Could we say like a tall tree? "You who weakens the nations. For you said, I will ascend to the heaven. I will exalt my throne. I will sit on the mount of the congregation. I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. I will be God," is what he's saying. I want that job. Lucifer, such an awesome, powerful, angelic being, believed that he could replace God the Father as the ruler of the universe. And of course, that wasn't going to happen. He was cast down, back down to the earth. He became our adversary. He became Satan, the devil. And that same attitude of "I will, my way," that pride, selfish ambition, greed, lust for power, is what has driven many men to acts of cruelty and destruction and guided men like Abimelech, who was willing to commit horrific acts of brutality to obtain power over people. He had no love, no compassion for anyone except himself. So I believe this parable, this story of Abimelech, preserved here in quite graphic detail. It's a hard story to go through sometimes when we consider what happened. But I believe it's preserved for the purpose of reminding us just how destructive the attitude of pride and lust can be. Of all people at that time, Abimelech should have been one who knew more than anyone what God was really like, what God was capable of doing if they just submit, if they just listen, if they just acknowledge Him, submit to Him. He'd seen the incredible miracles of God directly in his father's life. He knew the history of Israel. And he should have known God would help him too, that he could have been a remarkable judge over the people. They would have had many more years of prosperity and peace, long life. But he rejected dependence on God, and he and the people suffered. Many of them died. He refused to yield to God. He took upon himself to yield to his human nature and his attempt to take power and control at any cost. The cost even of the murder of his 69 brothers and the destruction and death of all of the people of Shechem. So as we close, what is the lesson for us? We must realize the destructive power of pride and vanity. How often we've talked about it. We dare not take this lightly. We dare not think that Satan cannot inject that attitude into us today, because that's his most powerful tool. And he will. He will use it. And we've got to be on our guard constantly and aware of his attempts to infect us with that. Today we're nobody. We're just trees in the forest. We're certainly not the tall and the mighty trees. We don't want to be. We don't try to be. In fact, any person who would attempt to rise up and be the leader of all the trees in the forest, to take responsibility, to take authority that does not belong to them, will also be destroyed, as will those who follow a false and a wicked leader, as was Abimelech in Gaul. Gaul was a counterfeit. Great God must be our great tall tree today, our supreme leader. We have seen the miraculous power of God in our lives. We cannot forget it. We must not forget it to our peril. We are like the Israelites at the tall oak tree of Shechem, aren't we? Remember what happened under the terebinth tree at Shechem in the time of Joshua? Israel made a solemn promise before Joshua. They will always serve God, no matter what. They will never turn back to idolatry. I'll never live that way again. And we said the very same thing on the day that we were baptized. The Israelites could not honor that covenant, that promise they made. We have no choice. We must. So we must never question that God is preparing us for greatness in his kingdom. If we learn humility today, we wait. We trust. For God, because he will be the one who will exalt us. He will bestow upon us the unimaginable power and greatness and glory in his kingdom. But not now. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. He will exalt you in due time. And that is the lesson of the parable of the trees.